You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest this week is Danny Fingeroth. He is an educator and the author of several books and is best known as a creator and editor of comic books, including The Amazing Spider-Man. His brand new book is a biography of the most famous of all comic book creators. The book is A Marvelous Life, The Amazing Story of Stan Lee. Danny Fingeroth, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
It seems incredible, to use a Marvel word, that Stan Lee and his collaborators just hit on the right formula at the exact right moment with Fantastic Four number 1 and Amazing Fantasy number 15.
Well, you know, it was one of those overnight successes that took 20 or 25 years. You know, both, you know, Stan and Jack Kirby, who co-created and drew the Fantastic Four, and Steve Ditko, with whom Stan co-created Spider-Man. They'd been around for quite a long time, so they had sort of done their woodshedding and gotten all the bad stories out of the way, you know, and they were looking to do something different, and kind of were all in the right place at the right time.
How did they suddenly figure out this idea of, I think, what you call forward storytelling or continuity?
It had been there kind of under the surface in the in the Superman and Batman stories of the era, where those stories would refer back to each other or back to things that had happened, or even just to say Superman's origin as the last son of Krypton. But you know, I think for numerous reasons, I think Stan and Jack and Steve liked kind of the movie serials and pulp fiction of their youth, and those would be told in chapters and would would proceed with developing characters to a certain degree. So I think they just amped that up. Somewhere they developed the idea that, oh, these are, if we have people with complicated relationships and who age to a certain degree and to learn from each of their adventures and each of their setbacks, you know, while we'd still be dealing with fantastical characters with superpowers and supervillains and aliens, you know, it would still give a more of a feeling than ever had been before of some kind of realism.
It's sort of a soap opera aspect of the stories.
It's totally a soap opera aspect of the story. I mean, that's one of the things, you know, that all three of them, and especially Stan, but Kirby too, had worked on many genres of comics. Stan loved writing humor. He loved writing romance. He loved writing soap opera. He loved writing monster stories, crime stories. You name it, he wrote it or edited it, or was a fan of it, or all three. And that, you know, I think what Marvel really was the coming together of all that experience with genre that all those guys had, and sort of putting the sign of the superhero over it. These are superhero stories, but while you're not looking, we're going to sneak in funny stuff and character stuff and soap opera and romance and fantasy and, you know, and hard-boiled crime and, you know. But definitely, I mean, comics in general are a hybrid medium like that. But Stan really, Stan and Jack and Stan and Steve really amped up the soap opera, both in terms of the emotional content of these stories and, as we were discussing, the continued nature of the stories that that either had literal cliffhangers or would certainly have leftover subplots, you know, and it kept readers, it was one of the things that kept readers absorbed and coming back issue after issue.
Well, that genre-spanning talent of Stan Lee's is one of the most interesting parts of your book. I mean, most authors are known for one kind of work. It's as if, you know, Conan Doyle wrote romances and Raymond Chandler wrote monster stories.
I think it was sort of part of the job description. You know, comics was a notoriously low-paying and short deadline kind of work. And so if you were going to survive and thrive in it, you really had to learn to do as many different things as possible creatively.
Well, let's go back and talk a little bit about the years before Fantastic Four number one. I mean, you said that they'd all been in the business for a long time. I think Jack Kirby had probably been in the business longer than Stan Lee because he was like the office boy when he first got in.
Stan came on board, right. The company was called Timely then, and they had been publishing pulp magazines, which are the kind of precursors to comics, pulp, printed on very cheap paper, and they were genre material in prose, but they were they had illustrations, but they were, you know, looked and felt more like traditional prose, and then this comic book fad came around, which was. You know, comics have been around since the early 30s, but it was really Superman in 1938 that jump-started the superhero fad, which then became sort of comics' trademark. There were still plenty of other genres of comics, but the superhero really pumped up the volume. And so Stan had started as the assistant to Joe Simon and Jack Kirby, who were the editor and art director, respectively, of Timely, and they also were the co-creators of Captain America, which was very popular. It was selling a million copies. It might have been one of the first comics besides Superman to ever do that. And, Stan was a distant relative of the publisher, and half the people who worked at the company were relatives of the publisher, as was the tradition at the time, and maybe even today in family-owned businesses, and so they gave Stan this job, literally sweeping up, pencil shavings and erasing stray pencil marks and filling in backgrounds with black ink and going out for lunch. And, he'd had a bunch of other jobs since graduating DeWitt Clinton High School in the Bronx about a year and a half before. And there was no reason to think that he would keep this job any longer than the half dozen other jobs he'd been through. But obviously he had literary ambitions, and he had wanted to be an actor, and this, and then before he could even, make that kind of big decision, he was a teenager. He started when he was just about to turn 18, and then Simon and Kirby had a dispute with Goodman over promised royalties that they believed he was holding out, which he probably was, and so they resigned. And Goodman said to Stan, "Can you take over as editor until I find a real grown-up?" And that was 1942, I think.
And he remained editor forever.
He remained with Marvel forever. He remained, I guess, technically he remained editor, or they didn't call it editor-in-chief then, but that was essentially what he was. He remained editor for about 30 years, and then he spent another 10 or so years as publisher, and then he had a lot of different executive titles until the end of his life.
Well, like the film industry, the early comic book industry was pioneered by Jews. Is there a connection there? Why were so many Jews involved?
It's one of those things that I've written a book about, so I should have some expertise. So on the one hand, you could go, who the hell knows? But I mean, the New York was the home base for the comic industry in the early days, and it was also the center of where Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe who came over, in the late 1800s and the early 1900s came over, and it was like the garment industry and other kind of looked down on businesses. It was looked down on. Comics was being in comics was not seen, you know, as any parent's, you know, hope and dream for their child. It was it was in this very low-rung branch of the publishing business. It didn't have as much prestige as, you know, as regular mainstream publishing, and those houses were largely run by people. You know, they might have had a couple of token Jews in them, but they were essentially restricted, and advertising the same way. So if you were like a teenager or a young adult with the ability to draw or to write stories or to do design work, a lot of doors were closed, and this comic book business, which was often published by the same people who put out, I'll call it pornography. I mean, by today's standards, it would be pretty tame, but still, it wasn't the highest class work. It paid very little, but if you could do a lot of it, you could make a living. And so you have this phenomenon of these young Jewish and often Italian kids. Their parents, you know, some of them barely able to speak English, some of them immigrants themselves, and suddenly they're 17, 18, 19 years old, and they're making more money than their fathers. It was kind of a phenomenon that nobody wanted to stay in. Everybody saw it as a stepping stone into magazine illustration, or maybe the film business, or to classier magazines. You know, certainly with the opposite. You know, today there are people who go to school to learn to be cartoonists of varying degrees. That was not the case. The cartoonists were revered, and even that was really a largely closed to Jews in those days. But the syndicated cartoonists who had their work, you know, Popeye and Little Abner and Dick Tracy, strips like that, that was the Holy Grail. That was what everybody aspired to, because people who did newspaper strips could and did live like rock stars. You know, they were celebrities. They lived in, you know, opulent homes, and for some reason, not universally, but in general, they were more highly regarded than what was seen as a bunch of low life hacks putting out the comic books.
Yeah, I mean, Milton Caniff is more highly regarded, or was, than Jack Kirby at the time.
Sure, and people like Kirby were imitating Caniff. You know, John Romita, who came along a few years later, was also someone who put Caniff on a pedestal, and he deserved to be there. But, you know, Will Eisner was someone who revered those guys, but Eisner was a legendary pioneer in comics, both in comic books, but then he had a chance to go into syndicated newspaper comics with sort of a hybrid. It was a comic called The Spirit that was a comic book, but it was done as a newspaper insert. If any of your listeners remember, say, the old TV guide inserts, that would be in newspapers, or even today you see advertising material that's sort of almost a magazine insert. So this was an experiment, and I think Eisner was eager to do it, because even though it was still comic books, it would be in a newspaper, which would be a step or two up in terms of prestige.
I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with Danny Fingeroth. He's an author and educator, and his newest book is called A Marvelous Life: The Amazing Story of Stan Lee. Well, so given what you were just saying about how the comic book industry was open to Jews, when you talk about the era, you know, and our listeners may know that during the blacklisting time in America, anti-communist Cold War era, there was a huge anti-comic book era in which people were encouraged to burn their comic books in giant bonfires and so forth. To what degree do you think that might have been anti-Semitic?
I think to a large degree, although, I guess sort of analogous to the blacklisting in film, a lot of the people doing the blacklisting and a lot of people doing the critiquing of comics I don't say a lot, but some of the prominent ones were themselves Jewish, and saw the comics almost as an embarrassment, especially the horror comics of the 40s and 50s and some of the more gruesome crime comics. The most prominent was a guy named Frederick Wortham, who was a Jewish emigre. I wouldn't call him a refugee at that point because he came here in the 20s from Austria, I believe, to study psychiatry at Johns Hopkins. At a certain point, though, he realized that maybe going back to Austria or Germany would not be such a hot idea. And he was a very... most of the critics of comics came from a religious and a very conservative point of view. Wortham came from a more progressive, liberal, leftist point of view, almost seeing comics as part of a entertainment capitalist complex, you know, almost designed to oppress people with cynical narratives and exploitive sex and violence and sort of keep them kind of addicted to and buying these things. He was more concerned about children. And Wortham never advocated censorship, although I think he advocated restricting sales to kids under 15. He was a complicated guy. He was very progressive in many ways. He testified for the side of integration in Brown versus Board of Education. He was on the progressive side in many social conflicts of his time, but he definitely didn't get comic books. I think he maybe not being born in America, there was a certain quantity of irony that was lost on him, that even a kid reading a horror or a crime comic might get. But whatever the reason, I think there was an aspect of anti-Semitism in it, and maybe justifiable paranoia by the publishers. But yeah, you can read writings of the day that sort of, you know, imply that, you know, the comics, and again, to be more from the conservative point of view, but the comics were kind of the code words that are always used for an anti-Semitic, you know, screeds, cosmopolitan, urban, New York is often used as a euphemism for Jewish, and I think that was a large part of what fueled it. I think just that, yeah, that distrust of things coming from mysterious offices in New York by, and often published by, people with funny sounding or obviously fake names, such as Stan Lee. You know, if you're not Asian, which many people thought Stan was before meeting him, then Stan Lee is kind of a goofy name.
It's basically his first name.
Right, his name was Stanley Martin Lieber. And Stan Lee was the name that, when he was literally 17 years old, he took as a pen name because he was saving his real name for when he would write the great American novel. You know, a lot of, again, because comics was not looked on as something to be proud of doing, a lot of people changed their names or shortened them, you know, partly to disguise their ethnic background, but partly just to disguise their names so that when they, you know, when they started their real careers doing whatever they were really going to do, they wouldn't be embarrassed by having their names in these shameful comic books.
Wortham also had a problem with what's interesting, because I think it was Marvel that had the first openly gay character in Alpha Flight or one of those. And, you know, he was convinced that Batman and Robin were homosexual. And
he couched it. The phrase was something like, you know, that their relationship, and they were often seen, it was implied they were sleeping in the same bed, or at least the same bedroom, which I think, you know, probably had more to do with the artist just not wanting to have to bother to draw two beds, you know, or two rooms. So if you had a plot point that involved the two of them, as, you know, in their civilian identities. He was, you know, when homosexuality was considered an illness, you know, he sort of, I guess, bought into that, which seems odd for a guy as progressive in his attitudes overall as he was. You know, so he was a complicated, contradictory guy. And I mean, he wrote that, he did a lot of articles. I see in my book, a woman named Judith Crist actually reported on him a lot. She was of course, later became a very famous film critic, but she was a reporter for the New York Herald Tribune. And she wrote numerous articles covering him in a very sort of laudatory way. I think Wortham just felt that that he was an expert in, even though he was trained as a psychiatrist, he saw himself as an overall cultural critic, and that he understood things that other people didn't. So, you know, and just the name, he called his book that was sort of the crystallization of all his thoughts, Seduction of the Innocent, which is in itself is a very sensationalistic title. You know, I mean, you can imagine, and in later years there was a horror comic that called itself Seduction of the Innocent, and a band that called itself Seduction of the Innocent.
That's a great
title. That had a lot of TV child stars in it. I think Billy Mumy was in it, and a couple of other people. But you know, I mean, so he himself was not above kind of going towards a sensationalistic angle to get people to read his books and you know, and discover his opinions. You know, in his book, although I think many of the editions had the stuff, he printed a lot of what he considered the most salacious and suggestive panels, which later, for copyright reasons, obviously the publishers demanded they be taken out because they weren't making him look good. But certainly at first he felt it would be. He must have known that putting in those, you know, those sexy or those violent images would help sell his book. So in his own way, he kind of drank at the same well as the publishers of EC and Marvel and other comics.
I wonder if many years later, in 1966, when they brought Batman to television, if they created the character of Aunt Harriet so that it wouldn't look so strange that Dick Grayson and Bruce Wayne lived together.
I'm pretty sure that's exactly why they created Aunt Harriet. You know, that, you know, whether it was directly to, you know, make sure that they wouldn't be seen as gay, or just to have a maternal kind of character in contrast, I guess, because they also had a lot of sexy, you know, they had Batgirl and Catwoman, and, you know, so there must have been some, you know, sure. You know, the way that all the best decisions are made, a committee must have decided that someone like Aunt Harriet, I was being facetious, by the way, about the committee being the way that creative decisions are best made. But, I mean, that seems likely that that's why that character was in the TV show.
Well, you know, I think you just touched on one of the differences between comic books and the movies that are based on comic books, which I think a lot of people now watch the movies, have never read the comics, and I think that's the whole point. That is, a comic book is meant to sell, I don't know, 200,000 copies, and a movie has to appeal to, you know, millions of people.
Well, I'm sure the publishers wouldn't mind if their comic books sold millions of copies, but it does seem that even at its peak, you know, in the 50s, a popular comic book, you know, that sold a million or at most 2 million was considered, you know, an incredible achievement, whereas, you know, a TV show that was only watched by 2 million people would be canceled, you know. And, right, so it's a different delivery system, even if the stories are told in the same genre you know, I think also, of course, when Lee and Kirby and Lee and Ditko and Simon and Kirby and people like that, for, you know, of course, and of course Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster with Superman, and Bob Kane and Bill Finger, both of whom went to the same high school as Stan, when they came up with Batman, I think these things had not lapsed into formula yet. There was still some potential for a higher level of craft and even art. So even though they were genre, they were inventing the genre, and in the 60s with Marvel, they were kind of reinventing the genre. So it took maybe 5 to 10 years for the Marvel story, say, to become a predictable product. Those first 7, 8, 9, 10 years of Marvel, they were exploring and discovering new things. And the whole, what we've come to call heroes with feet of clay, hadn't become a cliche yet. It was new territory, and those three guys, as well as other people like John Romita and Larry Lieber, who Stan's brother, who co-created Iron Man and Thor, and Groot. You know, I think there was still room for artistic expression and innovation, and that never went away, but there, you know, I mean, because I know we have this whole controversy now about are the movies cinema, whatever the hell that means.
Right, right.
And you're talking to somebody with a degree in cinema, so, you know, so are they cinema, are they art, are they craft, are they product, are they, you know, certainly as, you know, 9, 10, 11, 12-year-olds, that was not on our minds, but even looking back, you can see that there was something about the excitement of inventing this subgenre of superheroes lent itself to some great discoveries. You can go back and read them, and there are some really crappy stories too. Nobody talks about those, but these guys were cranking out dozens of stories month after month. So not everyone was a gem. And not everyone was done by people as talented as Stan, Jack, and Steve. But many of them were terrific, and many of them really did blaze new trails in this kind of subgenre of more realistic superhero stories.
Well, I think that, you know, initial run on Spider-Man with Lee and Ditko, and then Lee and Romita, is one of the greatest things ever written in any form of literature. I can remember specifically an issue of Spider-Man that Ditko drew where Peter Parker never puts on his Spider-Man costume once in the entire issue.
Right. Oh, no, it's yeah, the stuff is brilliant. And I think it was the collaboration, you know, and whether these guys loved each other or hated each other or both at the same time, you know, the result is just some amazing comics. And I think you also can't separate it, you know, when you talk about the phenomenon of Marvel, that really started out with Stan's idea of himself as running kind of an advertising campaign. You know, in a not cynical way. I mean, I think he really, you know, with his bullpen bulletins and before that his answers and the letters pages and his and the you know, the ballyhooing blurbs on the covers and just the voice of the narrator, really he created an imaginary version of himself that was such a good friend to the kids mostly, and even to the teenagers and adults reading. It was somehow this, he wasn't talking down to us, he wasn't overtly trying to teach us lessons until later on he got a little more socially concerned. But it was just somebody who seemed to so enjoy what he was doing and so much wanting to tell you a great story and share his enthusiasm with you that it was really infectious. And I think that was as much of the experience. You know, when I wrote this book, I went back and read a lot of the old comics with the ads and the letter column answers and the bullpen bulletins and the you know, and the crappy paper and the off-register coloring, because Marvel was printed on cheaper paper at cheaper printers. And so it had a certain look and feel that was grittier than the DC and other comics of the day. All that together was an incredible adrenaline jolt for kids reading it.
I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with Danny Fingeroth. He's an author and educator, and his newest book is called A Marvelous Life, The Amazing Story of Stan Lee. Well, reading your book, Danny Fingeroth, I also went back and read a bunch of stuff, and I read a lot of things that I hadn't read before. You pointed out Rawhide Kid number 17, and I went and picked up those early Rawhide Kids. And it's interesting how the groundwork for Spider-Man is in Rawhide Kid.
In terms of the murdered relative and so on.
Yeah, his name is Uncle Ben.
Oh, that's true too. Yeah, well, there were. If you go through the Marvel comics of the era, you know, there are a lot of Uncle Bens. It might just be for the reason that Uncle Ben's rice was a popular brand then. And so, you know, at 2 in the morning when Stan had to come up with a name for a, you know, an avuncular character, it was like, I'll call him Uncle Ben. I mean, you know, or maybe he actually had an Uncle Ben. I don't know. But there are certain names and, you know, and even the best cartoonists have sort of, you know, a repertoire of like maybe 5 or 7 faces for each gender that they draw.
Right.
So there are themes that repeat. There are, you know, they were working professionals. Marvel in that late 50s, they'd been a huge company in the 40s and 50s, and then they had sort of the side effect of the Wortham and anti-comics crusading of the 50s. They also had a distribution crisis, and so they were suddenly overnight went from like 80 comics a month to 8 comics a month. So on the one hand, they frantically had to do a lot of work just to keep making the same amount of money as freelancers they did. But by the same token, they also had more time, because they weren't putting out 80 comics a month, they had more time to spend on each one. It was a sort of almost contradictory thing. But you're right, they certainly used a lot of the same plots and same character names, because I think they didn't imagine that somebody buying a superhero comic would be interested in buying a cowboy comic or interested in buying a Millie the Model comic. You know, that's, you know, my own memory of my first Marvel comic is, you know, is not early. I was there early on with Fantastic Four. But when I was a kid, maybe when you were 2, you'd go to the barbershop. And to keep kids occupied while they were waiting on getting the haircut, there'd be a box of comic books. And, of course, the comics would be the ones that nobody that nobody wanted to keep. So you'd have, like, Millie the Model and probably some of the Western comics. But Millie the Model was a humorous look, you know, at some fantasy version of the modeling industry written by Stan Lee, you know. So it was full of corny jokes and, you know, they'd give credit to kids for designing the various outfits the models wore. Although really, I think they just used the kids' names so that kids would get a thrill. I don't think they, I think they rarely used the actual designs that a kid would send in. Not that many, you know, 7-year-olds are great at fashion design. But a lot. So as we were talking about, what became Marvel was really a hybrid. And so here was Stan doing these humor comics. I always got a kick out of Millie the Model. You know, I mean, I don't know if I bought any issues, but I think I remember buying it. But certainly I was introduced to it at the barbershop. I don't know if they thought the same person buying Tales of Suspense that would have a different Jack Kirby monster every issue with the same. I don't think they thought that same person was buying Linda Carter Night Nurse. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And they probably weren't. So why not use the same names and the same plots? I mean, that was the thing with comics. Comics were always thought of as something a kid would stay with for maybe 2 years. So you see, so if 2 years had elapsed, why not even recycle the same plot or the same name? So it was this odd kind of business where it was a, you know, they had to make money by doing volume work, and both as editors and writers and artists, and yet they still wanted to be creative and clever, and amuse themselves if nothing else. And Marvel, I think, in the '60s, Stan was starting to realize that college students and even people who out in the work world who loved comics, they loved the comics of the '40s, you know, and early '50s when they were kids, but they were looking at them in a different way now. They were, you know, they liked the comic book format, and they were nostalgic about the comics of their childhood, but they were ready and wanted something a little more sophisticated, and that was around the time when Stan was getting very bored with the business. I think probably the other guys were too, and they wanted to try something new that could still appeal to children. Don't forget, he had the whole, you know, that children's publishing and comics in particular was in a kind of perennial, one of its many crisis eras, because you had the whole phenomenon of suburbanization. You know, when most kids lived in cities, a kid would walk or ride his bike home from school, he'd stop at a candy store or a drug store, and he'd buy an egg cream and maybe some licorice, and oh, I'll buy a couple of comics because they're really cheap. When you have a situation where a kid's on a bus or when a kid is being driven back and forth by their parents, suddenly that whole kid economy evaporates. You know, and so the world was changing. They just weren't, so they had to find a way to broaden the audience. And around that time is when people like Roy Thomas, who would go on to succeed Stan as head editor and writer, and a guy named Jerry Bales, who was a college professor in the Midwest, I think. You know, people like that suddenly started writing to Stan and to other editors, as DC too, and suddenly there was this realization that, oh, here are these adults. They like reading comics. They have a nostalgia for what they grew up with, but they want something a little different. And what can we give them that will make them buy the books and tell their friends?
Well, Danny Fingeroth, you only make a couple of brief appearances in the book, and so I'm curious about your own comic book career, because you were a writer and editor at Marvel, and you wrote a lot of Spider-Man and other characters. How did you come to work there?
You know, not unlike Stan. I mean, he had finished high school, and I think he wasn't interested in going. You know, his family was very poor, and even though he lived in New York, where they had the city colleges, which were free, I think he was very obviously very smart and creative and clever, but he wasn't a natural student. He didn't love school. So, and his family was very poor. He needed really to help support them in a major way. His father was chronically unemployed during the Depression. So Stan went to work at Marvel sort of while he was trying to figure out what to do. I sort of had a similar thing. I'd loved comics as a kid. When I got older and I sort of stopped reading the Marvel and DC stuff, I became interested in undergrounds and in the revival of Eisner's The Spirit that was happening, and in stuff like Harvey Pekar's American Splendor. So I finished college. I went to school at Binghamton University in upstate New York, and I had a very interesting education in film. And I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, although I had all, you know, my whole life I've been involved in creative activities of some kind. You know, I was on the editorial board of my high school literary magazine. And I really thought, well, it might be fun to work at Marvel Comics for a few months. And I had a contact that could get me in the door, not a job, but get me in the door for an informational tour, and that led to me getting an entry-level job working actually for Larry Lieber, for Stan's brother, who was running a department that mostly put out reprint material for publication in England, including something called Captain Britain. And excuse me, I that sort of opened my eyes to what possibilities there were in the world of comics, and it was a good fit, and I stayed with it for close to 20 years, kind of, you know, working my way through the ranks, both as an editor and a writer. It was a very enjoyable place to work, you know, aside from the occasional psycho, but I think you have that in any work situation. And it was inspiring in a way to sort of be building on what Stan and Jack and Steve and Larry and John and Don Heck and Gene Colan and all those people had started when I was a kid. It was, you know, I mean, sort of two of the kind of pinch me moments in my life were having two of my stories that I wrote drawn by Steve Ditko. And then I actually had a couple drawn by by Gene Colan. Kirby never drew anything I wrote, but I did work with Stan as his editor, oddly enough, on a couple of stories, which was surreal to say the least. So that was sort of the start of it. Was a childhood, you know, interest / obsession that I guess kind of like Stan. As a grown up, I found myself in that business, and I wanted to bring what I could, because there was always innovation going on. You know, I don't think it was ever that brilliant flare of inspiration and happenstance that happened with the birth of the Marvel characters in the 60s. But there was, you know, there were lots of talented people like Frank Miller and Bill Sienkiewicz and Walt and Louise Simonson, J.M. DeMatteis, Tom DeFalco, a colleague of mine who literally died today, unfortunately, a guy named Tom Lyle. You know, there were just Ron Frenz, Bruce Jones. You know, there were lots and lots of brilliant, creative, funny people, and so it was a great atmosphere to work in. We used to say it beats having a real job. It actually was a real job, especially at certain points, depending on what corporate entity was calling the shots. But a lot of the time, it did feel like we were beating the system.
What do you think of the comic book industry currently?
I think comics are in a very interesting place. Superhero comics do not have anywhere near the sales they used to have. I remember I've done a bunch of teaching over the years, and I was teaching a comics writing course at Brooklyn College once, and I knew it was sort of a general class that they weren't necessarily comics fans. You know, it sort of, I just happened, you know, for various reasons, it was more like a general writing, creative writing class. So I said, "Who here reads comics?" And of the 30 kids, you know, maybe two-thirds raised their hand. And I went, "Really? That seems unlikely." And then I realized what they meant was that they'd seen the Marvel and DC movies, and they counted that as reading the comics. So I think in the sense that the comic book, that the Marvel and DC are the, you know, owners of that quote-unquote intellectual property, you know, I think people kind of get their comic book fixed that way. But I think the other phenomenon is, of course, manga, which is very popular, you know, translated Japanese and Korean comics. And then there's this whole independent comics movement and the phenomenon of the graphic novel that was, you know, not invented by but popularized by Will Eisner. Full disclosure, I work as a consultant to Will Eisner Studios, and I run something called Will Eisner Week every March. You can find out about it at WillEisner.com. But anyway, I think that whole Will Eisner graphic novel phenomenon has created and opened the door to people who don't want to draw Spider-Man or Superman, but who have incredible talents as writers and artists and cartoonists and storytellers. And I think, to me, one of the most hopeful things for comics is how popular comics are with actual children now. Because for years, you know, there were no, you know, for like 20 years or 30 years, there were very few actual children reading comics. There would be, you know, every town or every school would have a couple of people who were really into it, but it wasn't that rite of passage that every child had in the 40s and 50s and even the 60s. But right now we have a phenomenon, comics for kids, comics for young adults. There's a woman named Raina Telgemeier who I can't believe is not more famous than she is, since she is the highest-selling graphic novelist in the country. She does comics like called Smile, about a young teenage girl getting braces, another one called Guts that's out now that's very popular. I mean, she's very prolific, and her stuff literally sells in the millions and goes back to press again and again. And she's part of a phenomenon of comics, not superhero comics, but comics that are training a generation or several generations of children to love comics, which we had lost for a long time. So I think, you know, whether people now are going to experience comics in print or on their iPads or on their phones or whatever the next, iteration of content delivery is, you know, I'm very pleased that comics are not becoming, you know, for a long time in the business, we would talk about that comics were becoming more like poetry or opera, that there'd always be a devoted audience but never a mass audience. And I think now there's a possibility, you know, that since people are learning to read them as kids and to love the medium, that I think there's a lot of hope for the future of comics in all genres.
Well, this book is called A Marvelous Life, The Amazing Story of Stan Lee, and the author is my guest, Danny Fingeroth. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, it was great fun. Let's do it again sometime.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.